This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On a warm Saturday morning in North Hollywood, California, 7-year-old Andrew Bridge was sent by his mother to buy a pack of cigarettes at the local deli. Before he returned to the motel where they were living, a sheriff's deputy picked him up and put him in the back seat. His young mother, Hope, stood outside the motel, barefoot, arguing in her bra with a well-dressed woman. Much later, Andrew would learn that his mother was a paranoid schizophrenic, though he'd heard her talk to herself, even witnessed a lapse where she slit her wrists and painted his name with her blood on the bathroom walls. That well-dressed woman drove Andrew away that morning into a foster care system that he describes in a new memoir called Hope's Boy. He survived it to become an attorney and a children's advocate. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Charlie Hess, whose letters to a convicted child murderer helped to unravel the ugly secrets of a serial killer. But first, if you grew up in foster care, call and tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Andrew Bridge joins us from our studios in Culver City, California at NPR West. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you so much.
And I have to note that you begin your book not with a story about your childhood and your youth and your mother, but about the discovery as a young attorney of a boy named Jeff locked in the basement of a foster care facility in Alabama.
That's right. I begin it with one of the very first cases that I worked on right out of law school. It was a very old case, a case that had been decided a number of years ago, actually decades before that, by Judge Frank Johnson in Alabama. This involved the rights of people in psychiatric facilities and in mental retardation centers across the state. And I was assigned to represent kids. And I found a boy who had been locked in the basement of this facility for days, as was a common practice. And it was a very important memory for me and one that I will never, ever forget. This was a facility that also had a practice and was confirmed by federal opinions of locking children in cells. Two boys who had been kept in these cells, which were concrete cells with dirt floors and a lamp hanging over a grate. One boy attempted suicide and suffered severe hypoxic brain damage. A second boy, following that attempt, succeeded and did die.
That experience, though, of being locked in a dark basement, that's something that happened to you, too.
Yes, that was an old memory and one that has never left, and I talk about it in the book, Hope's Boy. Right after I was taken from my mom on that Saturday morning in February, I was driven to McLaren Hall, which is it's now closed, but was one of the more notorious children's institutions in the country, and stripped of all my clothing, placed in institutional clothes, and then carried to a large dorm that had a massive grid of beds. These beds were divided by sex, so in my room or dormitory, there were probably 200 or 300 boys aged 6 to 9. And I was told to take my clothes off. And having only been with my mom at 7, I was too shy to do that. And the response was, as the others were marched off through the halls naked down to the showers, I was taken to a basement and put in a dark basement room.
For how long?
You know, I don't know. That's a hard memory. I will say that it was long enough to never, ever protest modesty again and to stay with me. It was certainly more than a night.
And the findings, as you describe these facilities in Los Angeles, where you grew up, not just McLaren Hall, but a loveless foster home that you went to shortly thereafter. Nevertheless, those facilities seemed to use psychiatric designations against kids who were not crazy, seemed to use punitive measures against kids who hadn't done anything.
Well, I think that's right, and that's a very serious problem that exists in our child welfare system, and in large part that's about money. The truth of it is, at the bedrock of the way foster care jurisdictions are paid today, they're paid principally by two things: the number of kids they remove from their parents and how long they keep them in care. Then in turn, they can increase those dollar amounts by placing on a child increasing numbers of deficits, increasing numbers of mental health diagnoses. And that increases the overall revenue that is brought in to providers. Unfortunately, what we don't do is there is no reward for actually meeting those needs. As a matter of fact, there's a disincentive because what will happen is the child's value to that given provider will decline. So
you also give some terrifying statistics at the end of the book, suggesting that of the roughly 500,000 kids who are in foster care in this country at this time, something like 3% could hope to go on to college, that most, in fact, will have to deal with homelessness and poverty in their lives.
Yeah, I'd say 3% is frankly a good number. Most put it a little closer around 2. And though I think one of the sadder statistics is that when you ask 70% of all former foster children say they would have liked to have gone. Only about half will leave foster care with a high school degree, and 60% will not have a job within 2 years of leaving care. A third of the boys are going to be in prison, and 84% of the kids who are left behind in the community will have already become parents themselves. I think one of the saddest things about this is these are not new numbers. These are numbers that we've known literally for decades.
Andrew Bridge is the author of Hope's Boy, a memoir. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you were in foster care, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read the stories of other listeners on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's get Nicole on the line. Nicole calling us from Cincinnati in Ohio.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I went into foster care when I was 14, and I was in 2 different group homes, and I'm trying to remember, like 3, 4, something like that, single homes. And you know what he was saying about the high schools or going to different schools, that made me remind me that I was in 6 different high schools, and I barely, by the skin of my teeth, managed to pass and get my, you know, high school diploma. But, you know, I was also thinking that, you know, the other kids that I met in foster care, they just gave me such a broader view of life. I had never really had much exposure to kids of other socioeconomic or, you know, even really all that much other races. And just the different views of life. And here I thought my situation was so bad. And then, you know, I meet this girl that never knew her mother, you know, that other stories that were just make you really empathetic towards other people.
And why so many high schools, Nicole? Because you were being moved around to different families?
Yes. Yeah, I was moved around to different families and different group homes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have that experience with her, Andrew Bridge, of learning a lot from other foster kids?
Well, I did. One of the things that I talk about in the book are the number of children who came in and out of the home that I lived in. I was the only child who stayed there for good, who stayed there from age 7 to 18 until I went off to college. But children would arrive in the mornings, the afternoons, the nights. They came over and over and would leave suddenly as quickly as they appeared. I will say also that as far as what Nicole says, her experience is by no means unique. The truth is that overwhelmingly foster care records for kids, you know, their high school records are paper records. They're kept in folders that children are often expected to carry from placement to placement. Schools, I'm actually on the board of a school that specializes in work with foster children. Schools often receive records that are fragmentary, where they have no idea how many classes a kid has taken, where they ought to belong in school. And the same thing, quite honestly, happens with their medical records. They end up being re-immunized. Children go on and off of medications, all sorts of things like that.
It's interesting. Yeah. Nicole, one of the things that Andrew writes about in his book is, as a kid, they had special lunch chits for the foster kids in Los Angeles, and about the stigma of waiting till the end, just before the line was about to close, so he could still get something to eat but reduce the exposure to those who would now know that he was a foster kid. Was there tremendous stigma of being a foster kid when you went to high school?
For the most part, it wasn't really known by the other kids, but it was by the teachers. There was one group home that I was in that the teachers had to sign off on what my homework was every day. So as a sophomore in high school, that's not exactly the funnest thing to do. And so, I mean, there was a little stigma there, but I really didn't get to make friends much through the schools because one school I was there for 2 weeks, and another, you know, I didn't even go to school for the entire fourth quarter of my sophomore year, and just because everything was so crazy, and they ended up having the court had to have a judgment for me to become a junior, to be able to go on to the next grade, because I was in the hospital a little bit, but, you know, and just going around from various placements and stuff. and they had to have a court order to have my transcripts from one of my schools because they wouldn't release it.
Nicole, thanks very much for the story. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can talk with Ilsa. And Ilsa is with us on the line from Louisville in Kentucky.
Hi.
Hi there.
My question is completely from the other side. My husband and I have thought about becoming foster parents. We have two girls and have always wanted to do it. The reason we keep delaying it is because I tend to travel a lot for my career, and also we don't have a full third bedroom with, you know, privacy and whatnot. And I've always felt that if you're going to be a foster parent, you should be, you know, Donna Reed, and give this child the ideal, most perfect place you can. But from hearing these stories, it sounds like even our less than ideal accommodations might be a good thing for one of these children. And I just wanted to get his perspective on that.
Andrew Bridge, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I want to say that's a wonderful thing that's something that you want to do for these kids because they need that kind of concern and affection that is so absent from their lives. I don't know what the particular requirements are within your jurisdiction, but I can tell you that we ought to make accommodations on certainly those physical sorts of things. I think the thing that we ought to do that isn't done is to provide support to foster parents so that you feel comfortable taking in the kids that you take in, so that you receive the type of training for the type of children whom you're going to receive, and so that those children don't get moved over and over again, which is one of the most damaging things that happens to a child. So I commend you. I think that's absolutely wonderful.
Ilsa, good luck.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the phone call. We're talking today with attorney Andrew Bridge about his new memoir of growing up in foster care. It's called Hope's Boy. In just a few minutes, more of your call. So stay with us. 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join the conversation, the email address is talk@npr.org. You can also check out the blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what it's like to grow up in foster care. Close to 500,000 children in the United States are in foster care right now. Andrew Bridge is trying to shed light on their experience with his new memoir, Hope's Boy, his story about growing up in a foster home. If you have a story to share, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And again, you can go to the blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Eric. Eric with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi there.
I was in foster care much like Nicole. I went in at 15 and ended up running away, went to two foster homes, ended up living on the streets at 17 back in the 70s, and was actually very fortunate, was very lucky, and had the people I ran in with ended up really taking care of me, and so ended up finishing high school and going to college. And the purpose of my call is really to put in a plug for an organization called CASA, a Court-Appointed Special Advocates. And once I changed careers a couple of years ago and I started kind of reliving my past and got involved with them, and the CASAs are volunteers who work a lot with foster children as their advocates in court. And what I find most valuable about it is it's hard a lot of times for both the parents and the kids to just wade through the system as it stands today. And as a CASA, I really feel like I've made an impact in a few kids' lives and making sure the court, you know, does what's best for them. So,
is that an organization you're familiar with, Andrew?
Absolutely, and I'm glad that you brought it up because I'm happy to give them a plug, too. Court-Appointed Special Advocates, CASAs, are also known as GALs, or Guardian Ad Litems. They exist across the country, and the truth of it is these are volunteer folks. These are folks who we have too few of and who are often given the most difficult cases, the cases that have kids who have the highest needs, and the ones who find solutions that have eluded dozens of lawyers and judges that have preceded them. So absolutely, they are an absolutely wonderful group and play a very critical role in the foster care system.
I'd also... My current client is actually going through adoption right now, which is a real success because it doesn't happen that often. And besides the plug for CASA, I would just put a shout out to men out there, because it's largely populated with women, and nothing against women, but many times a man's influence is just important. And your CASA, if you ever want to get involved, I recommend giving your local office a call, because especially a man, a professional man who's got some time and got some interest in working with the courts and the kids, more than welcome.
Thanks very much for the call, Eric.
Here's
an email we have, this from Daniel in Louisville. My father was in foster care with all of his siblings because they were subjected to alcoholism and abuse by their parents. I firmly believe he'd be a different person, namely one that I would not like very much, or even further, that I would not be here today if not for that. He never spoke lowly of his years in foster homes. And I guess, Andrew Bridge, there's no denying that for some children there's no other option.
Absolutely. For some children, there is no other option. What I would say, though, is that with every bit of respect to that individual and not knowing anything about or nearly enough about his background, we have made progress in dealing with those situations, and that today what we try to do is go ahead and provide services that would have not removed his father from his parents, but attempted to treat his alcoholism, the alcoholism of his parents and the difficulties in that home, in a way that kept them in that home safely and that allowed those children to stay where we all know children belong. Children ultimately belong with their parents. That's where they do best.
Your mother was clearly having serious psychiatric problems. Would she have been able to take care of you, do you think?
That's a very, very hard question for me to answer. Today, there's certainly a large intersection between mental health needs and foster care. In my mom's case and Hope's case, with what existed at the time, probably not. And I talk about that in the book.
You do.
My mom, in many ways, I think many people would say that my mother had failed. I think that one of the great mistakes that we make in foster care, and I think as a society, is that we have a good deal of trouble acknowledging that failure and love can exist side by side. And in that way, my mother, for all of her failings and for her terrible, terrible illness, succeeded. She taught her little boy that she loved him, and he carried that love, and I carry that love inside of me today. It was what made me feel safe when things weren't safe, and it was what made me trust people when I had very little reason to trust people. Yeah, that's very important.
Let's talk with Kim. Kim with us from Hot Springs in Arkansas.
Yes. My family, my husband and I are foster parents in Arkansas right now, and there's a great deal that is still broken with the system, although I have to say it's come a long way since the author was in care in terms of group homes and that type of thing. We have three children of our own. We both have master's degrees. We have dedicated our lives to providing care for children in the foster care system, but the system is still broke. Our caseworker at one point this summer had over 90 children on her caseload. As an ad litem and an attorney serving children in care, what are some of the reforms that you still see that are needed? And second of all, you commented that children ultimately belong with their parents, but in some instances, situations, it seems that sometimes we carry parents' rights too far and the children end up suffering. Could you comment on these issues for us?
Yeah, I think that the first issue in terms of reform, there are a number of things that we could do. As I mentioned earlier, foster care departments across the country are reimbursed on the basis largely of how many kids they remove from care and how long they take them into care. And what that means is when a social worker goes out to a family, she is too often faced with a choice. They can either take the kid into care or they can walk away and do nothing. And that's not the sort of system that we want.
No.
I'll use Los Angeles County as an example. The very first outlines of a waiver to that system that was going to provide more flexible funding took over 5 years to get through the local, state, and federal government. We need to go ahead and provide more flexible funding that meets the needs of families in a country where we all value families. I think we need to respect those families. Now, as far as other issues of reform, one of the other great areas, and it sounds like you've received quite a bit of training, I commend you for that, but the truth of it is that we do a very poor job at going ahead and taking a look at outcomes. We provide providers with an extraordinary amount of money in some cases. Annual costs can range anywhere from $60,000 to $120,000 a year per child in foster care. And what we don't do is we don't look at the outcomes, or we're willing to accept those outcomes. And so we don't go ahead and provide providers, for example, incentives that are going to ensure that, hey, you know what? Your kids all went to high school every day, all, you know, for all that last semester, or they all got A's, or forgetting school, you saw a child's talents in sports or other talents, and you went out and you met those needs and those strengths, and we're going to compensate, we're going to go ahead and provide assistance to you and reward that.
When you speak of providers, are you speaking of foster parents or institutions? Or because I know as a foster parent, we're compensated not nearly enough for what it costs to.
You bet you aren't. You bet you aren't. And I'm actually speaking largely across the board when it comes to the kinds of incentives that we give. When the fact that we give the largest incentives to providers who can identify kids' deficits and then do little to go ahead and help those deficits. And do nothing to the provider who identifies strengths. But when it comes to individual foster parents like yourself, absolutely. I mean, I can tell you, in the case of California, that I know best, there's a lawsuit about this. In the state of California, if you kennel a dog for a month, you will likely make more money than if you are to take a child, a foster child, per month. You will receive a higher rate of compensation. And that's a problem.
Yes, yeah, and because many of these children, my master's is in development, and so we're equipped to work with children and families. But, you know, so many of these children come to us from such severe backgrounds, mm-hmm. and they require such a great deal of care and nurturing, and it's a lot of work.
We could hear children in the background there, Kim. How many do you have in your home at the moment?
I have three of my own, a 14, 12, and 9-year-old of my own, who are very much, we're a foster family, not just foster parents. And then I have a 5.5-month-old and a 4-year-old in the car with me right now who are in foster care with us right now.
I think we're hearing the 5.5-month-old.
Yes, you are.
Kim, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Here's an email from Rosetta. I'm a clinical social worker for a foster care agency. I appreciate caller's concern about her home being what she considers to be less than ideal. Unfortunately, while I still want to believe most people have good intentions, I come across far too many people who open their homes to foster care, but it turns out they're really in it for the money. It's terribly frustrating, and don't think for an instant these kids are unaware of the motivations. And I think that was a part of your experience when you were growing up, wasn't it, Andrew?
Well, I will say that I never asked my foster family if that was why they kept me. And that was, quite frankly, that was a question that was beyond my capacity to ask. That was a question that I did not want to know the answer to. That would have involved a great deal of pain, regardless of what it was. But was I aware that they were being paid? Absolutely. Is every foster child aware that they are being paid? Absolutely. And when that comes in the context of a system that does so little to go ahead and remind a child of, despite all the failings of their parents still have something to offer them, their parents still love them, you end up with terribly, terribly damaged children. You know, I'll say in my case, for example, as much as my mother was incapable of getting me dressed in the morning, feeding me, then getting me back from school and putting me to bed, what she was capable of was loving me. And that could have been preserved. And what didn't need to happen and what did happen was we didn't need to be limited to 1 hour once a month visits. We didn't need to be limited to 15-minute phone calls once a week. That's not the way you preserve that love and attachment, and that's certainly not the way you achieve reunification with a parent if that's going to be possible.
You also describe your foster mother as a woman who was had terrible experiences in her own childhood in Eastern Europe during the Second World War. And much of her family was destroyed in the Holocaust, and she herself was in a concentration camp. Yet she took her rage out, you say, on the children in her home, not just her foster children, but her own children. And you describe her as having an intuition for invisible wounds and say she loved the feel of swift, final judgment. A terrifying woman to live with.
In truth, she did frighten me as a boy, very, very much so. I think that I think that she had a very difficult, hard past, and I have forgiven that. I don't carry that around me with me today, and the book actually has very little to do with her. It is much more about me and my mom and a boy's refusal to give up on his mom. Mm. But yes, that was a scary thing. It was an episodic, unpredictable rage that frightened me.
Andrew Bridge is the author of Hope's Boy, a memoir. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get back to the phones. This is Drew. Drew with us from Lawrence, Kansas.
Yes, hi there.
Hi there. Go ahead, please.
I was calling. I've been a foster parent. I'm also an adoptive parent. I have several points, but one of the ones I always tell people is it sounds so horrible what they put these kids through, and it is horrible. What I found being a foster parent is that the system is only concerned with safety. They're not concerned with changing schools. They're not concerned with their records. And it's the people I've worked with are great people. It's that they can't be concerned with safety. I've had a child that was due to graduate from a school in 2 weeks, you know, 7 miles away, and had them say, well, what school shall I put him in? You know, and I'm like, what are you talking about? You're going to change him 2 weeks before school's out? Well, we can't take him. I mean, they're so overwhelmed that it seems to me their only concern is safety. I found that over and over again. And then another point is that they're supposed to give you so much information and tell you everything this child has been through. And I can tell you from personal that they don't.
Yeah, Andrew Bridge has talked about that, the difficulty of keeping up with paperwork, medical records, school records, all of that sort of thing. But on that first point, what do you think, Andrew?
Well, safety is the number one concern that you need to have for a child. I might put it a little differently if looking at large agencies and looking at the way foster care agencies react. I think that one of the saddest things is that when you look at large foster care jurisdictions, and I don't know where the caller was calling from, but if you look at Los Angeles, you look at Cook County, you look at New York, what they have failed to do is shed a decades-old legacy, and that is that what they are predominantly is massive bed agencies. And what that means is what they do best is they find a bed for a child. What they do not do is meet individual children's needs. So in the case of a foster parent where a child exhibits a particular need or a foster parent has a particular need, rather than addressing that need to keep that child in that placement and to continue to give that child that sense of belonging and permanency, they respond as a bed agency, which means they move that child. And so what happens, because the system is still largely based on papers we've talked about already, you go back and you look at a kid's file after 5 years and you say, oh my gosh, this kid has been in 14 different homes over the last 5 years. And the reason largely for that is because what is done is we simply provide a bed after a bed after a bed. On the issue of social – on the issue of, you know, helping individual foster families, I think a lot of this is really has to do with the failure to allow social workers to do meaningful social work. Of all the dozens of social workers whom I had, I remember the name of only one. And I'm glad that I do. And she did a great deal for me and helped me a great deal ultimately. But we need to go ahead and support those families in a way that we don't. We need to provide social workers the kind of support that they don't receive.
Drew, thanks very much for the call. And we just have a minute with you left, Andrew, but the first step, if you're going to do that with social workers, would be to reduce their caseload. In other words, hire a lot more social workers.
I think you need to hire – well, actually, I'd go – I don't mean to be too argumentative, but I'd go one step before that. I'd go and say what we need to do is to find out how we can best keep kids with their own families safe and together with the folks who know and love them best. And then after that, if we cannot do that, then ensure that we provide enough support and enough social workers to go ahead and do their job effectively.
Andrew Bridge, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Andrew Bridge is the author of Hope's Boy, a memoir. And he joined us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. You can read more about the time he spent in foster care and his mother's story in an excerpt from the book at npr.org/talk. When we come back, the story of a former federal agent whose correspondence with a convicted killer helped solve a cold case, well, a lot of cold cases, a case of serial murder. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.